This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Millions of people have been displaced by war in Syria. An estimated 4 million have left the country in perilous treks across borders, on land, or in rickety boats. But it was the image of a drowned boy, 3-year-old Aylin Kurdi, who washed up dead on a Turkish beach that caught the world's attention. The photograph triggered outrage, sadness, millions in donations, and perhaps some guilt among those of us living comfortable lives, knowing that tens of thousands of children like him die every single day. There are people who devote their lives and considerable resources to saving the world's most vulnerable people and animals, sometimes putting themselves or their families at risk to help complete strangers. Larissa McFarker is staff writer of The New Yorker, and she profiles extreme do-gooders in a new book called Strangers Drowning, grappling with impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help. And Larissa McFarker joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When you told people that you were writing a book about do-gooders, that's the word you had to come up with, some assumed that people so committed to others are mentally ill or perverse. They're targets of derision and contempt. Why is that? Doing good is so suspect.
This really surprised me. I mean, I started out on this project just wanting to know more about people who devoted their lives to others and what those lives were like and what those people were like and how they came to that sense of duty. And the first sort of person that I interviewed was a group of people who had donated one of their kidneys to a stranger. And I was startled to discover how much hostility they had encountered in doing it. Their family would object. They would say, well, if you've got a spare kidney, how about me or the children? What happens if we get sick? Why are you giving it away to a stranger? Even the doctors were profoundly suspicious of these would-be donors and subjected them to batteries of psychological tests to make sure they weren't nuts, that they weren't doing it for some unacceptable reason. And indeed, about something like half the transplant centers in this country won't deal with altruistic donors at all, people who want to donate to a stranger, because the whole concept is too weird to them. And I ended up sketching a whole history of the origins of this skepticism. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations famously introducing the idea of the invisible hand, the idea that all of us acting selfishly can collectively bring about more good for society, perhaps, than if we tried to achieve that good. To give just one other example, there was a French anthropologist named Marcel Mauss who in 1925 wrote a book called The Gift, in which he discussed traditional societies he'd studied and pointed out that in those societies, giving was always reciprocal. A gift given without expectation of anything in return was not, as we often think of it, thought to be a higher, more selfless act. It was quite the reverse. It was thought to be aggressive because it gave the giver more power. It caused the recipient to lose face. It made him look dependent, a charity case. And in one of the languages Mauss studied, a gift given without expectation of return had a synonym, poison.
We've brought up so many interesting things there. I'd love to just kind of break some of them down. This kind of idea of the familial relation of those who are the do-gooders, which comes up in an extreme form in the case of Hector and Sue Badeau, if I'm pronouncing their name properly. French-Canadian family, settled in Vermont, and adopted adopted all of these other children, you know, of various different needs, some of them really troubled, some of them physically troubled, emotionally troubled. So we get to see, like, what's on the other side of heroism, of do-gooderness. How does it affect the people who are supposedly being helped?
It can be very, very complicated, and I'm glad you brought this up because, to my mind, this is the deepest conflict that do-gooders face. You know, when we think about the barriers to helping others more than we do, we usually think of fairly petty things like, oh, we're too selfish, we're too conventional, we're too lazy, we're stuck in our ways. All of that is true, of course, but there's a much deeper difficulty faced by do-gooders, which is that if you're going to care for strangers and devote your whole life to them, it's going to conflict with your caring for your family. And most of us not only want to care for our family, we feel that that's the right thing to do. So we find it a little strange and a little worrisome when a do-gooder is willing to put his family aside in order to help somebody else. So the Badeaus are a more complicated case. It wasn't so clear, family versus strangers, because these are a couple, as you say, who adopted 20 kids. In other words, found 20 children who were still strangers to them and made them into their family. And in the early days, it was easier because the family was more manageable. It was four, it was five, it was six. But as the family grew larger and the kids grew older, before adopting new kids, Sue and Hector would hold a family meeting. And usually the kids were in favor, but as the family got bigger, they started to object. And they would say things like, "Mom and Dad, we don't get enough attention as it is. It's too big. This family is big enough. You got to stop adopting." This would affect them like it would affect any parent. And yet that was not all they thought about. For them, they thought, well, it's true. If we bring in another child, another four children who have most of them profound needs, it will take away some of our time and attention from the children we already have. On the other hand, think of those children whom we don't yet know, but we know their situation and we know that their lives are going to be so much harder if they don't have parents, so much worse if they don't have a family to call their own, that it's worth it to make the children we already have suffer from a little less attention if it totally transforms the life of somebody else.
That's what's so fascinating to me, the moral calculation that goes on for people. And this leads to the title of your book, Strangers Drowning. Now, this is from an essay from the philosopher Peter Singer. It was called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And basically, he observed that if you walked past a shallow pond in which a child was drowning, you would consider yourself barbaric if you didn't come to the child's rescue for fear of muddying your clothes, right? So there's this argument that he makes that it doesn't matter if you can't see that child drowning across the globe. They are still drowning. Wouldn't you do everything that you possibly could in your power to change this? So it opens up this whole dynamic of the spatial nature of giving help, that if we can't see, if somebody is not close to us in our own family, we won't extend the same kind of help, or there won't be the same kind of urgency. How does that play out in the lives of the people that you profiled?
It's a very good question, because I think for most of us, space and proximity are very deep moral facts. Peter Singer tries to make us feel as though space is morally irrelevant, and therefore it should not matter at all whether this drowning child is right in front of us or halfway across the world. But actually, proximity is a very deep fact to most of us, and so is vividness. If we see a child in front of us, we not only perceive that need, but we feel it. And if we see a photograph, for instance, of that poor toddler that you mentioned earlier, drowning off the coast of Greece, we are moved to help him in a way that we weren't, even though before we knew that there were people of all ages drowning off the coast of Europe because they were refugees, but we didn't feel it until we saw that photograph, many of us. That's one of the differences between the people I'm writing about, these profoundly committed do-gooders, and the rest of us. They don't need a photograph. They don't need to see someone right in front of them, because they have, I came to think of it as almost an aesthetic ability to conjure vividly in their imaginations the suffering of people whom they will never know, never meet. They feel it. So, for instance, I write about a couple who live just outside Boston, Jeff Kaufman and Julia Wise, and their form of altruism is fairly abstract. It does not involve seeing people right in front of them. It involves writing checks. When Julia was in college, she thought, I should become an aid worker in some foreign country. And then she thought, actually, here I am living in America with a first world education. Probably the best thing I can do is not go over there to some foreign country that I don't understand and try to be an aid worker myself, but stay here, earn money, and send as much of it as I possibly can. And she and her husband send away 50% of their salary, joint salaries, Send as much money as I possibly can to effective charities who can then use it to bankroll 3 or 4 aid workers who would be much more effective than I would by myself. When people hear about their story, I find that sometimes people find it unmoving and even repellent, the idea of an altruism that is so divorced, as they see it, from empathy, from the feeling you get from seeing someone in need. But for Julia and Jeff, it's a kind of modesty. It's a realization that they could use their resources trying themselves to help people in their neighborhood, but they would be less effective than if they gave as much money as they possibly could to aid workers who know their own countries better than they do.
What leads people to do extreme good in the world? And why are some people so committed to helping others, even complete strangers, sometimes at the cost of their own families? Well, Larissa McFarker is with us. She's a writer for The New Yorker, and she's written a new book about extreme do-gooders called Strangers Drowning. There is a moment early in the relationship of Julia and her then-boyfriend, Jeff Kaufman, when he buys her a $4 candy apple. Right. And it provokes such anguish in her. Like, I could have bought a malaria net for that $4. You know, there's a question of what is enough. And that's where I see the passion and the warmth. But there's also activists who get together and say, you know, there's kind of a humble bragging about you can save more lives than Oscar Schindler doing this, or I've saved more lives than Superman. If human lives are on a spreadsheet, that feels to me cold. That feels to me calculating.
There's no question that there are some altruists who think about their altruism in a very cool, rational way, and they don't necessarily get moved to tears by the suffering of people far away. They just coldly decide, it is my duty to help them as much as I can because I have so much and they have so little. It's simply what I must do. Now, I think such people deserve enormous credit because they have done much more than most of us do. In the case of Julia and the candy apple, that, you know, it's a funny story because this was Julia at age, I believe, 21 or 22. And she was still at a very overwhelmed, passionate, emotional stage in her moral life. It's hilarious to think about. And indeed, Julia herself finds it hilarious now because she's done something that's very hard. Over the course of her 20s, she's now, I think, 30, she figured out, along with her husband, a system that would set some moral parameters because they both realized that evening, if Julia was going to burst into tears every time she made a tiny little purchase because she thought of malarial children sort of clawing at her windows and saying, how could you, she was going to lose her mind. Right. And that was not going to be to anyone's benefit. Another decision that Julia and Jeff had to confront, which was a much larger decision than a candy apple, was whether or not to have a child. Julia had always wanted to have a child since she was a child herself. She always used to imagine games she would play with her kids, toys she would make for them. And then at a certain point, it occurred to her, oh, if I have a child, that will take away an enormous amount of resources that I would otherwise have given to charity. So by having my own child, I will, in effect, be killing other people's children. Mm. And then eventually she realized, you know, if I don't have a child, that will be the point at which I feel like my life is not just constrained, but blighted. And it will destroy me.
Paul Wagner is the man that you profile who gave a kidney to a stranger that he found on, you know, a website who was needy. His original instinct was to not let that person know who he was. He wanted to do it anonymously because he suspected his own motivations of heroism, you know, his own ego appeasement. And we mentioned earlier how people sort of feel judged by do-gooders. I wonder if we knew more about what these people were doing, about their sort of normal acts of heroism and selflessness, would we be encouraged to do more ourselves?
That's a very interesting question because we may know that giving more makes us happier, but if we also feel, perhaps even unconsciously, that giving more will make us into a different kind of person, someone more self-righteous, someone more judgmental, then our desire not to become that person may be too strong for our impulse to give. So that was part of the reason I wrote this book, was I wanted to restore a sense of the beauty and the grandeur of very moral lives, which I felt had become obscured with all kinds of cliches and notions about how do-gooders are unhealthy and twisted and generally weird. And I wanted to give a sense that these people are tough and relentless and extraordinary, and hopefully by so doing, take away some of the barriers to the rest of us wanting to do more good.
Larissa McFarker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Larissa McFarker, she's staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. There's much more on the book. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org.